I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. On a tiny South Pacific island in the Marquesas, the painter, Paul Gauguin, built a small thatched hut and carved himself a wooden door frame with the wish that here would be the place to end my days without a care of tomorrow in the endless battle against the imbeciles. When Gauguin died there, at the age of 54, the local Catholic bishop dismissed him as, quote, an enemy of God and everything that is decent in this world. But even then, the art of Gauguin had already started to attract attention. There was sculpture, there were woodcuts, and then there were the oil paintings. Dark, lush, tropical jungle, bright pink sand, and those sensual, coppery, muscular bodies of the women, naked or wrapped in their colorful cotton sarongs. The popularity of the art scattered it among collectors and museums around the world. An exhibition, just opened at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, has brought much of it back together. This hour, we'll talk with the curator and other fans of Gauguin. We want to hear from you as well. What do you consider Gauguin's legacy as an artist? Do you think his work is even more compelling because of the life he led or in spite of it? And what about his work speaks most loudly to you? Is it his attempt to capture a primitive paradise? Or is it the color that he called the language of the listening eye? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, if you'd like to take a closer look at one of the paintings that we'll be focusing on in the program here, one entitled Where Do We Come From? What Are We? Where Are We Going? You can go to our website. We're at theconnection.org. There's an interactive multimedia tour of the entire exhibition there. You can see every single painting, but you can also take a magnifying glass to Where Do We Come From? Look at the painting in detail and listen to some of the commentary that's on the web. That's something that you can do at theconnection.org. I'm joined now in our Boston studio by George Shackelford. He is co-curator of the Gauguin Tahiti exhibition at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, where he is also chair of the Art of Europe. Nice to have you here.
Glad to be here again.
You must be very proud of the exhibit.
It's one of the best things I've ever been able to work on. I'm very proud but honored to be able to work on such a project.
Can I ask you if even now you walk into the exhibit and can be distracted by something, or when you live that intensely with something so close to your face, do you just sort of go, oh yeah, that's the exhibit, I did that?
No, you make discoveries every day. I mean, I'm still learning about this artist and his work by being able to live with the things brought together from places all across the world. I mean, there's one wall in the show where five very closely related objects come together from Kurashiki, Japan, Grenoble, France, Des Moines, Iowa, Boston, Massachusetts, and Washington, D.C. And you see them differently together than you would if you saw them sequentially in those places.
A lot of the work that you put into it, George, was pulling together pieces that were component parts or related to or a part of this great masterpiece that really owns the show at the end. I encourage people to take a look at it, but there is something about turning the corner in that particular room and looking at this 12-foot-wide canvas of Gauguin's. It's called Where Do We Come From? What Are We? Where Are We Going? And the questions themselves are in many ways a way that you use to strike a theme for the show.
That's right. It's probably the largest blockbuster-ish focus exhibition that we've ever worked on, because the show really tries to answer for this masterpiece, Gauguin's greatest work, the questions that the title poses. Where does the painting come from? What is it? And what are its sisters and brothers? And where does Gauguin's art go after Duvenant-nous, its French title? And so because the MFA owns this and has owned this great painting since 1936, it really lies at the spiritual heart of the exhibition. It's not really in the center. It's not really at the end. It's the kind of lodestone that the whole exhibition is drawn to.
Now, for people who might not know his work or this particular piece, what can we do to give them just a visual sense of what's happening in that painting?
Well, the painting is dominated by the colors of blue and green. It's a very wide landscape in which, at the right, a river rises out of the ground and then flows towards the left across the middle ground of the canvas. In the deep background are views off to an island, a volcanic island of Morea in the distance at the left, and then a kind of dark forest at the right. Across the foreground are disposed figures, fairly large scale. At the very center, a man standing in a white loincloth reaches up to pluck a kind of mango fruit, almost like Adam in paradise. And then to either side are seated on the ground women, children, animals, goats, dogs, etc. The painting, Gauguin says, you know, begins at the right with the river and a sleeping child. What are we? Or rather, where do we come from? At the center, a man.
A sort of androgynous man.
It's pretty androgynous, yeah. I think it's pretty clear when you look at the way Gauguin paints the women's bodies that in fact, it is meant to be a man. And it's based on a drawing of a man by Rembrandt, or thought to be by Rembrandt at that time. But it is a somewhat curious figure, and some scholars have linked it to the Mahu kind of shamanistic man-woman that existed in Tahitian culture at the time. That's what are we in the center. And finally, the old woman near to death, as Gauguin says, at the left represents where we're going.
Now, one of my own guides for the new exhibition was Elizabeth Childs. She's a professor of art history at Washington University in St. Louis. She's a Gauguin expert and wrote for the exhibition's catalog. I asked Elizabeth to give me something of a lesson, to take me to what most of us would know as a fairly classic Gauguin image, a woman half covered by a sarong, standing in the lush surroundings of Polynesia. Actually, in this one, she's not covered. She's covering herself with her hand. But to show me what I might be missing on that first glance. So Liz took me to a painting called Words of the Devil.
It's got beautiful tropical foliage. It has this nude woman in the foreground, and then this kind of mysterious figure crouched in the background who looks human but not quite human. So in that sense, it might be typical. But there are many references here. Gauguin brings to his experience in Tahiti his knowledge of Christianity, his knowledge of Christian art. And what you really have here is a reworking of the idea of Eve. This is really Eve after the fall. And it's in her posture, in her gesture, in her modesty as she covers herself.
Yeah,
she's covering just part of her body. And also in her look of slight anxiety. It's the story of Eve. So you have something of a Christian motif. And then behind her, you have this figure who's an articulation of an evil spirit. And here it is. It's the Varua Ino, Parauna te Varua Ino, which translated means words of the devil. So you have
is
this.
Is that a more Tahitian figure, or is that still bringing some of his own Christian sensibility?
This one is more a Tahitian figure, so he's combining and synthesizing the Christian tradition with what he's encountered and hearing about in Tahiti. Moreover, in the background, you have these wonderful fluorescent lights, which really are like plants that cast off a wonderful color and light and fragrance. And they represent the forest, but they also represent a spirit world that he's heard about. He's interested in, maybe a little anxious about, completely enamored with, and wants to somehow represent. And to represent it, he even includes a little mask figure that is based, actually, it's right up there in the corner. Oh, in these paintings, it's wonderful. You just keep looking, and they just keep giving back. They give more and more forms the more you look.
Elizabeth Childs is joining us now from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri. She's a Gauguin scholar, as I said, and professor of art history at Washington University in St. Louis. And are you missing the exhibition, Liz?
I'm a bit jealous you're there, but really it's okay. Good morning.
And you two, of course, have worked together.
Hey, Liz,
for a long
how are you?
Morning, when, George.
George and Liz, when you look more carefully at these paintings, there is, as Liz was just beginning to tell us, there's so much more going on than just the figures, just the dark jungle, right, George?
Absolutely. I spent several days alone in a paintings conservation studio with this picture, just looking sort of inch by inch, foot by foot, making notes and trying to describe what happens in the painting. It's not easy to do because it's a very complex, very layered picture. And the more you look, the more you see.
And Liz, how much of what we see in the Tahiti paintings, the ones that we're talking about on this program, are a mix of Gauguin's own Christianity and the sense he was trying to make out of religion elsewhere in the world?
He's certainly on a quest, I would call it a quest, to make sense of his own faith and then his own doubt about the cultural institutions he was raised in. And I think he's probing questions from the point of view of comparative religion, from the point of view of his own experience. And he finds Tahiti this beautiful, inspiring milieu in which to examine these questions. And so it is a mix. It's a mix of the inheritance, the artistic inheritance, the intellectual and religious inheritance, and in this wonderful world that he's encountered and that mystifies him, intrigues him, and compels him. So it is very much a hybrid.
What's fun about this, too, George, is that if you ask of Gauguin, a sort of hybrid of his where do we come from, where did he come from question, this guy was a businessman in Paris. He was a stockbroker, a Sunday painter.
who became a collector of the Impressionists and befriended them and was invited to participate in their exhibitions. So he really rises out of a world of Impressionist art, I mean a bourgeois background. But remember, he does, in fact, join the Merchant Marine and sail around the world. So he's had a bit of an experience as a sailor. But yes, coming back to Paris, marries, joins the stockbroking world, collects paintings, and then gives it all up and goes out on his own and, you know, leaves his wife and children in Copenhagen and comes back to France, goes to Brittany, makes a great leap forward in 1888, and is never the same.
Was the talent always there? I mean, when you try to make sense of somebody who comes to painting in as late in life as Gauguin did, was it his exposure to, you know, the world fair that led him to believe there were paradises elsewhere? Was he a possessed man, or was the talent always there?
Well, I've got to say that you look at the early works and the talent doesn't always shine through in the way that it does after 1887, 88. But then in the late 80s, it's a radical parabolic rise where between with works like The Vision After the Sermon, which your reviewers may remember, of a group of Breton women staring at Jacob wrestling with the angel, or in our own great relief from 1889, Be in Love, You'll Be Happy, this incredible carving that he does in that year, you really see an artist going out on a limb that no one's ever been on before.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, a chance to reflect on the brand-new exhibition, Gauguin Tahiti, at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. We're talking with the curator this hour, taking your questions about that man, his life, his art. And Liz Child, of course, is also going to be with us for the balance of the hour. And we'd be happy to have you with us on the program, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for NPR.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, something of a chance to celebrate the art of Paul Gauguin on today's program, in main part because of the new exhibition that's at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, Gauguin Tahiti. And we have the curator, George Shackelford, here with me in the studio. Liz Childs is joining us from a studio in St. Louis, Missouri. And we're joined on the line from Lima, Peru, by Mario Vargas Llosa. He is the author of many novels, including his most recent, The Way to Paradise, which has on the cover The Spirit of the Dead Watching. It is a well-known Gauguin painting, and in fact, it is a story about Gauguin himself. Mr. Llosa, it's Mr. Vargas Llosa, it's nice of you to join us.
Hello, good morning.
Tell me about your fascination with Paul Gauguin. I understand that the two of you share the same hometown.
Well, yes, You know, very few people know that Gauguin lived in Lima, Peru, the first 6 years of his life, and that in a certain way, this Peruvian experience had an influence in his paintings and also in his vision of the art and of the world. This is something that gave me my first interest, my first curiosity in Gauguin. But the book that you have mentioned, this novel, actually it started as a novel based in the life of Gauguin's grandmother, Flora Tristan, who was a very interesting, you know, social agitator,
trade unionist,
feminist, and well, the novel is about both characters, the grandmother and the grandson, Gauguin.
Now, the way to paradise is in many ways a short way of encapsulating Gauguin's life. He was searching for paradise, but he had a kind of disappointing end to his life, Mr. Vargas Llosa. He didn't really find the paradise that he was seeking.
Well, it happens always when you look for the impossible, when you fall to this temptation to the impossible. Paradise is not in the living world, you know, and Gauguin, as many utopians of the 19th century, politicians, ideologues, poets, painters, were looking for something that didn't exist in this world. But what is interesting is that in their search for paradise, for a perfect society, they produce, as is the case of Gauguin, an extraordinary work which give us an idea of what is total happiness, total beauty, a perfect world. I think this is the great contribution of Gauguin, this kind of utopian vision which will mark profoundly the modern art. 20th century is marked by this influence, and I think Gauguin was one of the real pioneers of modern art.
When we look at his art, George Shackelford, I mean, do we see that the sort of influence that Mr. Vargas Llosa is talking about, the little bit of his childhood spent in Peru? I know he boasted of...
He certainly boasts. He says preposterously, "I have Inca blood in my veins." But I mean, he means that.
He said, "I am a Sauvage Peruvian, a wild Peruvian." Huh?
Yes, absolutely. And he continues throughout his life to, you know, to sort of talk about this experience. He goes to the Museum of Man and finds there a mummified body from Peru that becomes a sort of like image icon for him forever from that part. You see it as the old woman in our painting in Boston. So, yes, I mean, I think there is a very clear importance that Peru had for him. I think the fact of having been so far from France for the beginning of his life also made him recognize that although Paris was the base for his audience, that the other end of the world might be a better place to make art.
And Liz Child, when he went in search of whatever he imagined might be primitive in Tahiti, was he taking along with him his sense that the search for paradise, the search for that Eden, was something that was a little bit more than just a personal quest, but something important to his art as well?
I think he went with all optimism of a dreamer. I think he brought with him the visions of literature, the visions of art, the belief that somehow it would be better and he would make a better art for being there. And when he got there, he had to deal with the realities that anyone encounters when a dream butts up against, you know, the actual world. But he kept carrying it with him, and he looked and he found a way to create images that somehow resounded with that dream while still nonetheless exhibiting the encounter. which is what his life and his art was all about.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll take our first call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bob's on the line. Bob, thanks for calling. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Are you there?
My point is I went to the lecture at the museum the other night, and I went to the showing of his work, and I found it remarkable that there was very little reference to and very little reason behind why he had abandoned his family, and the fact that he had died of syphilis. And I happened to have sailed to Martinique, and there's a small town in Martinique called Saint-Pierre, and in that museum there were many letters between him and his wife, where his wife was pleading with him to come home and be a father to his kids and be a husband to her. And he was very abrasive in his and uncaring in his relationship with his family. And it seemed like this guy just went off and had a good time. And I'm not denying his talent or his art, but I think that when, and even in your show, when you talk about it, none of the psychological reasoning behind who this man was and how he behaved seems to be addressed. You know, they went, oh, yeah, he left his family in Copenhagen, but then you move on to he followed this romantic dream.
Okay, I will get to that in just a minute, Bob, with the exhibition that you saw, but I want to first sort of run that past Mario Vargas Llosa, because these elements of this man's life were all a part of what you have to include when you think, okay, I'm going to include him in a novel.
Well, you know, he had this romantic idea of the artist as someone that is different, that cannot be submitted to the same laws and uses than the common people, that because he was an artist, he had to experience all kind of adventures, and particularly adventures that were behind or beyond, you know, common moral uses, customs. And that is what he admired in the primitives. He had an idea of the primitives that was totally romantic. The primitive is someone who has no rules, who can satisfy all his dreams, his instincts, his appetites. And this is what he went to look for in Tahiti. You know, actually, he didn't find exactly that. But as he didn't find it in the real world, he invented it and put it in his paintings.
Let me hear from Liz Childs on this, Liz, because I think Bob's right to point to these somewhat unsavory elements of the man's history. But you also tend to cut him a little slack, don't see him as the nasty character that he can be seen as, right?
Well, I think one needs to place it in history a little bit and to realize, yes, of course, what your caller says is very true. He did, quote-unquote, leave his family. But in the late 19th century, many people of lower middle-class means often separated for long periods in order to pursue careers or livelihoods. Sometimes it was city to country, sometimes different countries. And even Flora Tristan, his grandmother, left her children with family members while she went off to be a nanny in England for several years. So it wasn't only men who would leave their families in order to pursue what seemed to be necessary. And, you know, he never divorced Matt. And there are letters of a certain tenderness for quite a period. It's a very long period where they remain in touch. And it seems to be the death of the daughter that really causes the final break and the final sort of rupture of any kind of intimate relationship by letter. I'm not pretending that these things don't happen, but I think it helps to put it in a larger context of social practice and to realize that these kinds of separations, these kinds of relations shouldn't necessarily be judged by 21st century standards of what constitutes family. It's not that unusual when you look at writers and traveling men of various sorts in the late 19th century.
George, when you're putting together an exhibition of some scope, you have to take this into consideration. What do you do with it?
Well, it's certainly not as a family man that we admire Gauguin. We admire him for other qualities, and yet I do think he has a profound sense of wanting to question society and morality through art in ways that are very different from his own personal behavior. I think he gives something to the world of spirituality that doesn't have to do with conventional religious faith, and he makes us in a painting like Where Do We Come From? He makes us examine ourselves through his art and through the power of its not only its title, but also and its imagery, but also the pure visual power of the color and form, so that we, in a way, we come away from the painting, I think, better people, perhaps. That may be a bit of a romantic notion. I don't know whether Mr. Vargas Llosa would think I'm dreaming, but we do have, I think, to admire him for that ability, if we don't think that perhaps his way of living was the best.
Mr. Vargas Llosa, does the art have that much power?
I agree. I agree entirely. You know, I think he was a very great artist. From a personal point of view, of course, there are many, many things that are unacceptable in his behavior. We must at the same time recognize that he suffered terribly, that he had a very, very difficult and sacrifice and heroic life. But it is true that he was not a model character, particularly in moral terms. In our days, he would be considered, for example, a pedophile, you know, and he would be, incriminated. And he thought that because he was an artist, he had the right of a kind of excessive life, you know, and that this was the privilege of the artist. He was wrong, but we must recognize that this was an idea widely extended, particularly during the Romantic period. At the same time, this kind of life, he paid for it. He suffered terribly, and at the same time, probably he wouldn't have painted what he painted without this kind of life.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana now. Jerry's joining us on the line. Jerry, thanks for calling.
Not a problem. I just wanted to comment that I didn't get Gauguin among all the Impressionists until I went to the old Jeu des Paumes years ago and saw his personal objects, that he had carved for himself, not expecting anyone to ever see these items. But that's what showed me what a great artist he was. He did these things just to please himself. He was so much an artist. By the way, I want to thank Mr. Vargas Llosa for all his fine works, and I'm a fan. Anyway, that's my comment. He's his colorist, too. That's something I came to much later, but just the fact of his personal logic.
Careful now, Jerry. You're giving us an awful lot to work with here. I want to start with where you began, and that is the influence of the icons, the iconography of that moved into his paintings and then moved from one painting to another. Because Liz Childs, when you were walking me through the exhibition, this is something that struck you about how something that he might have seen in New Zealand on one time would show up in a painting later, and how you get to play detective and pull all that back together 100 years later.
There's no question that one of the great opportunities of this exhibition is to be in the middle of the works, as George was describing, and to be able to see the relations between them in ways you simply can't. And it's just so clear this is a chance in a lifetime, because you see resonances, you see reinterpretations, you see echoes, and you see one form that becomes another in yet a related painting. It's extremely exciting. Part of what he's also doing is absorbing and re-articulating some of the various oceanic forms, the indigenous art forms that he's encountered in Tahiti and then later in the Marquesas. And I think for us, those are somewhat more subtle relations. And one of the things the show does that's terribly exciting is it puts wonderful works of art from Tahiti, from all parts of Oceania, on view, and you can see the relations yourself and see the way that he is moved, inspired, and yet not trying to copy and not trying to be an anthropologist. Just like I don't think we should necessarily judge him for his private life, I don't think we should try and judge him as an ethnographer who's trying to record things in a particular fashion. His goals are artistic, and he's a synthesizer, just as he was as an impressionist. He absorbed lessons and moved on with a wonderful creative rapidity and originality that is what keeps these works exciting so much later.
That bowl that Jerry saw in the Jeu de Paume years ago now belongs to the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, this new museum that absorbed the collections of the Jeu de Paume.
This is the large wooden bowl?
Large wooden bowl, and it's great to see it as represented in a painting by Gauguin, and then evidently after he had painted it, he decided to decorate the sides of it with carvings. And as Liz points out, most of those derive from his examination of Marquesan carvings, these wonderful patterned forms of whether it's stilts or these I don't know that they have a Marquesan name, but they call them in France casse-tête or head knockers, of which we have a splendid example in the exhibition. And we know that Gauguin saw these objects, admired them, and reinterpreted them on his own terms.
Mr. Vargas Llosa, just one quick last question to you. You mentioned that there's a little bit of Peru in Gauguin. Is there still a little Gauguin in Peru?
Oh, yes. Yes, because that's very curious, but I think he's well known in Peru most because he is the grandson of Flora Tristan, who is a national heroine. You know, I would like to mention something that I think it's also very important in the case of Gauguin. I think he was among the impressionist and post-impressionist a painter that reivindicated primitive cultures as a source of inspiration, as something that could enrich a Western artist.
Mr. Vargas Llosa, I'm afraid we're out of time. I have to say goodbye to you at this point. It's good of you to be with us on the program. That's the author, Mario Vargas Llosa. His latest book is about the life of Gauguin. It's called The Way to Paradise. We're back after the break.
Support for National.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking about a brand new exhibition at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. It is called Gauguin Tahiti. It is a collection of some 125 pieces. Some of those pieces haven't seen each other in the same gallery in over 100 years. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation about this remarkable post-impressionist painter. We're going to go to Boston next. Lana's joining us on the phone. Lana, thanks for calling.
Hi. I was just calling to make a comment about the painting you were talking about earlier, the Where Are We Going painting.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a letter that Gauguin wrote about the painting of this painting, and I thought that hearing his voice talk about it was interesting. And he had tried to commit suicide at one point in Tahiti. And right before he took the arsenic, which was an unsuccessful attempt, he wrote that right before he was going to kill himself, he painted this painting. And he said, I'll just read a sentence of his here. It says, they will say it's careless, not finished. It's true that one is not a good judge of one's own work. However, I believe that this canvas not only surpasses all of the preceding ones, but also that it will never do anything better or even similar to it. Before dying, I put into it all my energy, such a painful passion under terrible circumstances, and a vision so clear without corrections that the haste disappears and the life surges up. And I just thought it was interesting.
Have you seen the painting yourself, Lana?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I live in Boston, so I've seen it many times.
Did he get it right?
Well, I was an art history student, and I had to choose one painting to write a thesis about, and I chose that painting. So I guess so. It spoke to me.
George, he asks also a question, where does the painting of a picture begin and where does it end? I mean, I'm thinking of the letter that Lana just wrote us, your own description of the painting and the circles within circles of his own examination of his art and his humanity. It all got pretty tangled up at
Absolutely.
One point.
I'd say to Lana, first of all, the letter is here in Boston now, so come to the MFA and you'll actually see physically the very letter that you're talking about, and you can at least read the first page of it if your French is good, because Gauguin's handwriting is also so beautiful and clear. The exhibition gave us a chance to explore that question that he says, where does a painting end and where does it begin? Because we brought together with Where Do We Come From, our great painting, 8 of the pictures that Gauguin made to go with it, that were exhibited in Paris in 1898 for the very first time. They're here. They come from museums in Russia, in England, in France, in Denmark, and from a private collection in Tahiti. And to see them together, you get some sense that the painting didn't have an end, that it, once it was finished, however carelessly he had painted it, and I think he's being somewhat disingenuous in that regard, because I think he lavished great care on the painting. But once he finished it, he felt like it needed to have children, in a sense, and he painted this group of pictures that literally, for the first time since 1898, is joined together in the exhibition.
Now, Liz Childs, all these questions that he's forever posing to us make him sound more like a philosopher than a painter. There was part of that in him, was there not?
Absolutely. And it came through in his writings, which we know today, but I think not as well as we know the paintings. And one of the great opportunities at the show is that several of his manuscripts are there and that you can see his text, and there's even an opportunity to see a digitized image as page by page turns over. And one realizes the man wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages. Some of these are about art, some concern issues of art criticism, but then he ranges very far afield, and he thinks about really profound basic questions about existence. And one of the wonderful things about the painting is that it ties into several of these texts, one of which actually is from here in St. Louis. And in those texts, he starts to pose the questions that he then really examines visually as well. And I like to think of him as one of those wonderful creative spirits who's on multiple paths at once, and that his painting is all-consuming, and even, you know, his graphic works, his sculptures, but he writes because he believes in it, and it's another form of expression. And we lost some of the manuscripts at his death. As is well known, there was an estate sale, and some of the things disappeared, and we'll never know everything he wrote. But it's very interesting now to look at this painting and other works of the late career from the point of view of what he had to say about questions of existence. And certainly the questions he poses in this painting, he takes up again and again in his writings.
And I would say, add that Liz examines this very beautifully in the catalog of the exhibition. It's really, her essay is really wonderful about bringing Gauguin the writer face to face with Gauguin the painter. It's wonderfully done.
And one of the fun things that you have done also is given us a chance to page through this Noah manuscript, yeah, without getting all our grubby fingerprints.
Right. Well, if you had ever met Marie-Pierre Salle, who's the curator responsible for this, you would know how
quickly,
you
know, my fingers would be cut off.
Absolutely.
Right?
No, maybe not cut off. You might be pulled back by a wind, strong wind. Noah.
But we should emphasize that it's here and it hasn't been in the United States.
That's right. Ever.
It's
never been exhibited outside France, and since it entered the Louvre in the late 20s, it is a remarkable volume. Part scrapbook, part travel log,
sketchbook,
part sketchbook, and we have it open as it happens to a page on which there's no writing, because it's, for me, one of the most vividly beautiful pages
of
the whole.
Page,
and
it
involves collages. It involves photographs, cut out sections of a print stuck in, and then this wonderful watercolor that sort of links all of the collage elements into a beautiful opening. But you can see it. You can see the entire book on CD-ROM. The French produced this fantastic CD-ROM, so that for, you know, $30, you can literally examine every page of the manuscript of Noah Noah and its appendix, which is called Diverses Choses, or Miscellaneous Things, which has never before been transcribed.
And if we're whetting your appetite a little bit for the exhibition, a reminder that you can see the works on our website. The MFA has given us digitized copies, so you can take a look at some of this artwork. And it's, well, as close to the computer can get in reproducing this kind of color. We're at www.theconnection.org, 1-800-423-8255. And we're going next to East Lansing, Michigan. Elise is joining us. Elise, thanks for calling.
Oh, it's thrilling to listen to everything you're saying. I'm particularly interested in the connection between Gauguin and other painters like Van Gogh and my uncle, Dodge McKnight, who has paintings in the Museum of Fine Arts.
Now, these two, Gauguin and Van Gogh, had a 45-day period together in where?
In Arles, yeah, in the south of France at the end of 1888.
Was that you marked that earlier as a formative time for him. Was his time
absolutely.
With Van Gogh also?
Just before even, sort of winding up to leave for Arles. He was, painting portraits of himself to send to Van Gogh, and then their period together, I think, was one of intense competition and companionship simultaneously.
Well, they talked together, didn't they, Liz, about going off and setting up a studio somewhere in the developing world?
Oh, absolutely. And in some ways, we could see this exhibition, Gauguin in Tahiti, as a kind of continuation and culmination of the ideas that they, along with Emile Bernard, who doesn't have a place in this show because he didn't make it to Tahiti, but these artists had the notion of creating a utopian studio where they could collaborate and inspire each other and work together. And, you know, Vincent died and Bernard went to Egypt and Gauguin went on his own to Tahiti and was really only visited by one obscure English artist. Other than that, he had no contact in Tahiti with these artists he had known in France. But his hope had been that he would create this beautiful world, and it could have been a collaborative studio of the tropics. And in the end, he made that. But what he brought with him were the works of art, the little photographs that were his quote-unquote friends. And it was through these means that he created a studio of the tropics.
Thanks a lot for that call, Elise. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Next call to Brookline, Massachusetts. Nancy's with us. Nancy, thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm giving just an odd bit of information. 40 years ago, I knew an artist named Hugh Tyler, who was James Agee's uncle. And Hugh said that as a young man, he'd gone to Tahiti to find Gauguin's grave. And he said he found it in the jungle almost completely lost. And that his great pride was that he had found it and had marked it before it disappeared. And that's just a bit of odd information.
Did he say how it was marked?
No, but I think people can find the grave now. But he said he could almost not find it. He told me that 40 years ago.
He must have been in the Marquesas instead of Tahiti, because, in fact, Gauguin is buried, some 750 miles from Tahiti on his last island home.
Hivoa, yes.
And
it's possible it was overgrown, but it's quite easy to find now. It's in a churchyard, very clearly marked with Gauguin's name, and not quite in the jungle, but perhaps it was overgrown. It's very well-tended now, however.
No, he as a young man told me when he was an old man that he had found it and cleared it off so it could be not lost forever.
That's great.
That's all.
He did us a great service then, because I think there is an acknowledgement that for a long while, before Gauguin's renown grew so great, the grave was simply the grave of a guy misunderstood who, was barely buried by the bishops.
He didn't even want to be buried in a Catholic churchyard, did he?
No, there he is. And of course, subsequently, art lovers and Gauguin lovers have placed on his tomb a bronze cast of his sculpture, Oviri, which is as unreligious a sculpture as you could possibly place on a tomb in a graveyard in the Marquesas.
So what does he leave us then? Is it the color? Is it the mix of colors? I mean, when I think of him, I think of that combination of the deep, dark, sort of dangerous jungle and these fabulous bodies. But I mean, maybe that's just a superficial.
Well, you know, I think in the sort of mainstreams of modern art, family tree of art history, Gauguin is the branch of color, typically in simplistic terms. And if Cézanne is meant to lead to cubism, then Gauguin is meant to lead to Matisse and Fauvism. It's a lot more complicated than that, because you have to remember that if Matisse saw Where Do We Come From in Vollard's gallery at the end of the 1890s, so did Picasso when he got to Paris. We know that Picasso, who has a show with Vollard in 1901, I believe, saw the painting at Vollard's gallery, taken there by his friend Paco Durio, who wanted to buy the painting. And if it is Where Do We Come From that inspires Matisse's Bonheur de Vivre, it also inspires Picasso's La Vie, painted in the year that Gauguin dies. So, yes, I mean, it has a profound influence, along with the graphics and the sculpture and the carvings of various kind. We know that it becomes a kind of jumping-off point for a lot of artists in the 20th century.
Liz, how do you mark his legacy?
Well, there's many ways, and one very important way is, of course, the way George is speaking of its impact on 20th century Euro-American art, and it's had an enormous legacy. But I would also want to mention the legacy in Tahiti, which is complex and somewhat ambiguous and somewhat dualistic. On the one hand, not all Tahitians are thrilled Gauguin came. And for example, there's contemporary writers who are critical of the legacy and feel that they've been a bit exploited. And yet, on the other hand, I observed something last summer that was absolutely wonderful. The Musée d'Orsay sent a number of works for the first time to Tahiti to be shown because there was a museum that was able to receive them. And many of the Tahitians who were hired as guards were actually artists, and they wanted the opportunity to be around the works. And I have in my office framed this wonderful little sketch done by one of the guards who copied Gauguin's self-portrait. And I really felt it was full circle. Now we had the Tahitian artist copying Gauguin, and it seemed that that was also an important part of the legacy.
Liz, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Liz Childs is professor of art history at Washington University in St. Louis. George Shackelberg, great of you to be here. Thank you. George is curator of Gauguin Tahiti at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston. The exhibit is there until June, I think.
This is the best week to see it.
Special thanks to Mary Edwards at Station KWNU in St. Louis, Missouri, for technical assistance with today's program. A reminder, you can see more on our website. We're at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.